Here it is!
From deep inside your audio device of choice.
Beautifully autumnal day here in the Crescent City. It really is autumn in New Orleans. Who knew? Ladies and gentlemen, don't get me wrong. Actually, get me wrong for just 10 seconds. I love pie. Okay, don't get me wrong any longer. The facilities here at WWNO, the home station of this program, are fabulous. Unsurpassable, I think it's fair to say. Perfectly wonderful. So this is not in any way meant as a complaint or, any kind of whining. Whining would sound like this. But I did have the occasion, possibly because in my youth, I was once, I was working in an advertising agency, and I was trapped in an elevator at 5 o'clock in the afternoon with about 45 other people who just wanted to get the hell home. And we were there for 45 minutes or so. Did I use the number 45 twice? That's a bad sign. Anyway, one of them was correct, by the way. One of them was accurate. Maybe because of that, I've always been partial to using stairways since then, and which gives me a more than nodding acquaintance with the design ethics of stairwells. Now, we're living in a time, both in the United States and the United Kingdom, where people are talking about an epidemic of obesity. And all sorts of things are being bruited about as solutions for the obesity epidemic. Change your diet, take medication, discipline, lap bands, gap bands, whatever. And I'm a simpler kind of cuss. I'm thinking, based on my experience in the wondrous world of stairwells, well, you could try by getting the stairwells out of hell. You know, that would just encourage people just a little bit. I mean, you don't have to require them to take the stairs, but make it not a hideous experience. Here in fabulous home of New Orleans Public Radio, I don't think the ventilation systems, and they don't run the building. I'm not pointing fingers at them. I don't think the ventilation systems apply, shall we say, to the stairwell area. So there's that thing of you're doing this maybe for your health, and then you're breathing air that was last expelled in 1948. And also, you know, the decor of most stairwells that I've been in the last 7 decades leaves a little something to be desired in the eye appeal department. You know, maybe some ocean views or some views of what used to be national monuments. I don't know. Just something attractive. Anyway, maybe we could take the stairwells out of hell, is my suggestion for the day. Not just for here, but for everywhere. Now, we are told by CNN and NBC, among other media, those are the two that I've noticed, that Robert Mueller's office, the special counsel appointed by Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein to investigate any connections between the Trump campaign of 2016 and Russian attempts to influence the election. That office is supposed to come out with, has filed its first indictment. We may learn who has been indicted and on what charges Monday or even later, depending on how they like to work it. And of course, it being the weekend and it being Trump and Russia, just the airwaves have been filled with speculation about what this means and who this could be and what the charges could be. And on the Sunday Yak shows, Chris Christie, who was a U.S. attorney, and Preet Bharara, who was a U.S. attorney, discussed in great detail the process of how a grand jury indictment happens, except for one thing. They left one thing out, which is the thing that is the cliche that every lawyer and anybody who pays attention to legal stuff knows, which is the power of a prosecutor over a grand jury is such that a prosecutor could get a grand jury, and this is the cliche in the law world, the prosecutor could get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. Not a sandwich, a sandwich. Ham sandwich. Now, the rationale for this is that, in case you didn't know this, a prosecutor has sole and complete power over the information that's presented to a grand jury. There is no defense presenting an alternative view or attempting to attack the information of the prosecution. There is no judge to rule on inadmissibility of evidence. There's just a prosecutor filling their heads with whatever he wants to fill them with. This is not in any way to say that the person or persons who may or may not be indicted this week is or is not or are not guilty of anything. Not prejudging any of that. I'm just saying, going in, maybe we should be reminded, maybe we should have been reminded by somebody other than me, of the massive power that a prosecutor has over a grand jury and the results of that process. So it may be a horribly guilty person who's been involved in collusion that strikes at the very heart of American democracy that turns out to be the person or persons indicted. Or that is to say, it could be pork loin or it could just be a ham sandwich. Hello, welcome to the show.
This time I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm gonna need to parachute when I get through walking these blues. When I get back to New Orleans, I've got no time for talking. I've got to keep on walking. New Orleans is my home. That's the reason why I'm gone. Yes, I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm walking to New Orleans.
And for all those people who say, well, how do you people down there really pronounce the name of the city? There were two examples right there from New Orleans. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans, Louisiana. I'm Harry Shearer welcoming you to this edition of Le Show. And now, news from outside the bubble. Farming organizations in Great Britain have set new targets to reduce the use of antibiotics in raising animals for food in an effort to cut the widespread overuse that has been blamed as a significant factor in increasing resistance among humans. This is from The Guardian. The chief medical officer for England, Dame Sally Davies, has repeatedly said the rapidly increasing resistance to antibiotics and the rise of resistant superbugs is one of the greatest threats to human health, could make even routine operations life-threatening not long from now. Task force has been set up among organizations leading the British pig, dairy, and poultry farming sectors, attempting to bring down the number of antibiotics commonly used with the assistance of vets and farmers. The British government said sales of antibiotics to treat animals in that country had fallen by 27% in the last couple of years, also a drop of 83% in sales of colistin, an antibiotic of last resort that is critical for human health. WHO says that drug should be reserved for human use, almost never used in animals. Are we doing this over here? Somebody may know. That somebody is not me. The Department for Environment, Food, and Rural Affairs doesn't gather statistics on antibiotics used on farms except to record the volume of total sales in the UK. Vets are not required to report their prescribing practices. The drop in sales concerns antibiotics purchased from vets in the UK. An investigation by The Guardian a couple years ago found that strong antibiotics, though, were easily available for purchase, unrecorded, through the internet. A little bit of progress, but probably not enough. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Now, news of bad banks. And you know that this is an ongoing thing. One of the characteristics of the settlements that were trumpeted by the Obama administration, first among them the mortgage nonsense settlement with the banks that had owned subprime loans that were offered to people who couldn't afford them, and then people got foreclosed and blah, blah, blah. That settlement was announced with a great deal of attention, and about 50, almost all of the 50 attorneys general signing on to it. We found out later, thanks to NakedCapitalism.com, that many of the millions of dollars that were supposed to go to homeowners to relieve them of the problems of improper foreclosure that the banks were required to perform were actually things that banks would have done anyway. And they got credit for abiding with very stringent requirements that they were in their own financial interest to do in any case. Now, the New York Times reports, prosecutors have concluded one of the last multi-billion-dollar settlements related to the mortgage collapse. The deal with Credit Suisse required the bank, this is tough, to pay about $2.5 billion to settle allegations that its securities unit had misled buyers of home loan bundles, that is to say, subprime mortgages that were rated AAA between 2005 and 2007. Credit Suisse also agreed to provide, here you go, $2.8 billion worth of financial relief to troubled borrowers under the settlement, forgiving or modifying mortgages and helping to finance affordable housing projects. So far, so good. Prosecutors, when they announced the deal back in January of this year, prosecutors cited it as evidence the U.S. government can and will ride herd on large financial institutions. Get along now, financial doggies, if they engage in misconduct. Today's settlement underscores that the Department of Justice will hold accountable the institutions responsible for the financial crisis of 2008. That's a quote from Loretta Lynch, who was the last attorney general under the Obama administration. Now, a new report compiled by the independent monitor hired to scrutinize how Credit Suisse was living up to the deal comes, put simply, some of the settlement's terms, those involving consumer assistance, were easier on Credit Suisse than investors and borrowers may have wanted. The settlement terms relating to consumer relief are complex. They allow the bank to earn credit towards the $2.8 billion in consumer help by modifying troubled borrowers' loans. How much credit is earned by the bank depends upon what kind of modification. One of the monitor's tasks is to assume that Credit Suisse receives only the credit it has truly earned. No small task. Under previous settlements, some banks received credit for forgiving loans that had already been discharged in bankruptcy. It's win-win or lose-lose. Neil Barofsky was the first special inspector general for the Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP, which administered assistance to beleaguered banks, homeowners, and other entities after the 2008. Barofsky won't comment on his report, looking at the first 6 months of Credit Suisse's loan modification and forgiveness efforts. But a Credit Suisse spokesperson says, Credit Suisse has taken a number of positive steps since our settlement with the Department of Justice. So far, according to the New York Times, Credit Suisse is working diligently on the consumer relief aspect of the settlement. According to the report, it's meeting the deal's requirements. Nevertheless, a close reading of the 118-page analysis does raise questions about just how tough this settlement really was. The report highlights the significant benefits Credit Suisse received under provisions in a deal the prosecutor said would hold the bank accountable. For example, the bank can earn consumer relief credit for actions it would likely have taken anyway, the report said. More troubling, most of the loans Credit Suisse will receive credit for modifying are owned by others than Credit Suisse, specifically investors in mortgage-backed securities or rival financial institutions. Nearly all the loan modifications Credit Suisse's subsidiary will receive credit for will be performed on loans owned by third parties. And to the extent these modifications result in any loss, it'll be borne by the owner of the loan and not Credit Suisse, getting credit for costing other people money. Although allowing the bank to forgive loans it does not own, which the Credit Suisse settlement specifically does, thanks Obama, puts the bank in a position to benefit from others' losses. Bad banks, bad prosecutors. A marriage made in the United States of America. Bad banks, ladies and gentlemen. News of Bad Banks, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now. Time for me to read the trades for you. From a British trade publication, Insurance Business Magazine. Smart home technology. The next telematics. I'm going to read it for you. Only way to stop me is to turn off the... No, don't do that. We've seen technology transform the motor insurance market, that's cars to us, through telematics. Telematics is using data transmitted from cars to data collectors like insurance companies, and the growing production of connected cars. But smart home technology looks set to be the next to revolutionize the insurance industry. 75% of UK home insurers expect smart home technology to positively impact risk mitigation. But only a quarter of homeowners currently use connected home technologies, according to a recent report from LexisNexis Risk Solutions, pointing to a gap between the perceived benefits of the technology and its actual take-up. Got a makeup to take up. While the concept of connected homes holds huge potential for the insurance industry, it is still at a nascent stage, says Jay Borkakotti, Director of Home and Insurance at LexisNexis. Quote, as with every type of new technology, it happened with a smartphone, it happened with car telematics. You always have the early adopters who tend to be a very specific type of person, I'll say. And it stays like that for a while until you get a real following, Berkakoti told Insurance Business. We're currently only at, or even approaching, the early adopter stage. The speed with which smart home technology will change the market rests largely on the natural growth in take-up among consumers. Reports suggest that's set to grow, but insurers have a part to play too, according to Jay. Quote, the insurance industry without a doubt has a role in manifesting that and even in funding it. It makes sense for an insurer to, for example, pay to have the devices installed for its policyholders because of the increased ability to monitor and collect data. And also they know that the house is safer than one without a device in it. Unquote. Unless it's hacked. Then it's less safe. Go figure. Back to insurance business. The key risk areas addressed by connected home devices are currently around fire, theft, and escape of water. Risks are... which are considerable concern for both insured and insurer. When it comes to the home perils and the types of loss that insurers pay for, connected home technology plays directly into those because there's some type of sensor or alert for each insurance risk, Borkakoti said. Leak detectors in particular provide a key opportunity for insurers to save on one of the costliest areas within home insurance. Last year alone, escape of water claims totaled £667 million, Britain, for insurers. As for building momentum within the insurance space, the industry could benefit from a central database containing information gathered from smart home technologies which Burke Akoti said could help build scale. It's a central database, that's all. Nothing to worry about. It's just about scale. Quote, we're not in a position yet where there's enough data or enough momentum in the smart home area to use this as uniformly as we'd like to. The ultimate goal would be to harness the UK smart home data into one big pool so that insurers, among other companies, would be able to price more accurately using that one big pool. Come on! It's warm in the one big pool, isn't it? A tempting prospect. Made even more tempting when I read the trades for you. It's a copyrighted feature. Now there's news of the Olympic movement, not produced by Jim Ebersol Jr. this week. He's fighting some allegations. And fighting the alligators, to tell you the truth. Well, not to tell you the truth. There is no truth there. There is no Jim Ebersol Jr. there. But news of the Olympic movement. Radio Free Asia reported this week that the International Olympic Committee is willing to cover all costs for North Korea if it takes part in the South Korean Winter Olympics in February. Now, before we go any further, like you, maybe, I asked myself when I read that, Radio Free what? Radio Free Asia. Radio Free Asia, like the Voice of America, like Radio Free Europe, they're all still in business, run by the Broadcasting Board of Governors, and its mission, its mission statement, it's like Burger King, it has a mission statement, just not in the kitchen. Its mission statement says that it's to broadcast into countries in Asia to advance United States foreign policy interests. But that's not meddling, ladies and gentlemen. That's not meddling. The IOC told Radio Free Asia that it's ready to pay for all costs through the Olympics solidarity program if North Korea wants to compete rather than, say, blow up the games. You know, it's a 6-1. The IOC said that in order to help the North Korean Olympic Committee join training camps and compete in qualified events, it's cooperating with the Ski Federation and the Skating Union. Not what you think. They have not unionized skaters. The report also explained that the Solidarity Program is a fund coming from broadcasting profits. It's provided to national Olympic bodies that are in most need of financial aid. So if you connect the dots there, money from NBC would be going to North Korea. Something to think about. Something for Jim Ebersol Jr. to think about. The IOC added that it has also organized a special support program for North Korea's Olympic hopefuls to take part in preliminaries and training. Like they really want North Korea in the Olympics. And who doesn't, really, when you stop to think about it? But don't stop to think about it. Stop to enjoy.
He's not a general. He commands no troops. He's not an inspector. He peeks at no stoops. He's an inspector general.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
News of inspectors general, ladies and gentlemen. You know about the contract between the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority and Whitefish Energy? Whitefish is a Montana company. It had, according to reporting, two employees until it got this deal. It was apparently, was it a no-bid deal? And it's from Montana, which is the home of the Interior Secretary, Mr. Zinke. Well, that's the biggest yet awarded in the wake of Hurricane Maria. Whitefish is getting paid through FEMA. The Inspector General of FEMA's parent agency, the Department of Homeland Security, has repeatedly criticized FEMA for lax oversight of grants. The office frequently recommends that FEMA withhold or claw back payments that didn't follow federal regulations. As of September, there were $68 billion worth of ongoing FEMA grants spread across more than half a million projects. Multiple audits and reports by the Inspector General show a pattern of problems in how those funds were being spent. In June, the Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security, John Roth, sent a letter to the chairman of the Senate Committee on Homeland Security, Ron Johnson. The letter, which hadn't previously been reported until this report in Bloomberg, warns of FEMA's continued failure to manage disaster relief funds adequately. Well, that doesn't mean much because we're not going to have many more disasters. Almost one-third of the grants reviewed by Roth's office were improper, unauthorized, or otherwise problematic, indicating the potential for a much larger problem with the $10 billion in such assistance FEMA typically awards every year. That's our disaster budget. The letter was the result of a frustration and our lack of progress in getting FEMA or Congress to pay attention to this, said Roth in an interview this week. The trigger, he said, was FEMA's decision to give $2.1 billion in grant money to New Orleans, ostensibly to help it recover from Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, more than a decade after the fact, like recently. An audit by the Inspector General concluded FEMA shouldn't have awarded the grants because it was for rebuilding streets and water lines that would be degraded by years of neglect, not the hurricanes. FEMA, said the Inspector General, should halt or disallow all funding for the work in New Orleans. Now, I'm just going by the words of this story, and I care a little bit about this, ladies and gentlemen, because I'm in New Orleans. Unlike the situations in other cities where floods come and go within a matter of days, the flood in New Orleans, which was, as listeners, regular listeners to this program can recite along with me, not caused by a hurricane, but caused by the catastrophic failure under situations far less severe than those advertised to be able to withstand of a hurricane protection system built by the Army Corps of Engineers. That resulted in a flood that didn't go away in 2 or 3 days or a week, but that kept major parts, up to 80% of this city, inundated for up to 6 weeks. That is the effect on the streets and on the understreet infrastructure that these funds were meant to remediate. Just a little thought. Anyway, FEMA, for its part, disagreed with the finding of the Inspector General, arguing that extensive reviews showed the work would repair damage caused by the storms. Here they go again. The storms. I guess FEMA didn't want to blame the Army Corps of Engineers because, you know, they share a cafeteria. A spokeswoman for FEMA said the agency appreciates the insights and candid recommendations from the Inspector General and that FEMA has taken steps to improve its grant management. She called the instances where the agency disputed the Inspector General's recommendations rare. In his letter, Roth painted the picture of an agency that is fundamentally unable to manage grant money because of both cultural and structural problems. 29% of the FEMA grants audited by his office in 2015 showed problems such as duplicated payments, unsupported costs, improper contract costs, and unauthorized expenditures. Since then, audits have found flaws in multiple FEMA-funded projects, large and small. In June, the Inspector General recommended FEMA disallow funding for almost half the $3.2 million approved for Hays County, Texas, to cover damage caused by severe storms and flooding 2 years ago. The audit found the county secured FEMA funding to remove 20 times as much debris as it actually needed to collect. Tut-tut, Hays County. Tisk-tisk, Hays County. In September, the Inspector General warned of a lack of basic controls in the $1 billion that FEMA expects to give Texas for temporary housing for victims of Hurricane Harvey. Quote, "We are concerned that without adequate controls in place, the federal funds may be at risk of fraud, waste, and abuse," says the end of September report from the Inspector General. So I gave you a bit of salt to take with that report based on what I know. And the U.S. ambassador to New Zealand has been counseled on standards of conduct for government employees after an investigation into his behavior at a party in Samoa. "Please, sir, I want Samoa." Last summer, U.S. officials from the State Department's Office of Inspector General flew to New Zealand last week to interview Scott Brown, former Republican senator from Massachusetts, and reported their findings on what happened at a Peace Corps reception where Brown caused controversy with remarks to volunteers serving food and other guests. I think the writer here means volunteers serving food and remarks to other guests as well, as opposed to volunteers serving food and other guests. Because the other guests probably would object to having been, A, cooked and then served. Brown admitted to the New Zealand news website Stuff that he'd been admonished for what he said was his praising of the appearance of several of the party's attendees. He also said he had remarked the waiting staff were good enough to earn hundreds of dollars in the U.S. According to the British newspaper The Guardian, the two complaints that were subject to investigation by the State Department, IG, originally came from two female Peace Corps volunteers who were at the event and who served food and drink to the guests as a way to 180 the cultural norm of Samoans serving Westerners. But in addition to these complaints, guests at the party have alleged to The Guardian the ambassador's behavior was, quote, shocking, quote, culturally insensitive, quote, rude, and, quote, undiplomatic. State Department takes allegations of misconduct seriously. We investigate them thoroughly, says a spokesman for the State Department, who is very nice looking. No, sorry. Senior leadership at the State Department has been in contact with Ambassador Brown. He's been counseled on standards of conduct for government employees, which also includes ambassadors. This was a party celebrating 50 years of the Peace Corps in Samoa. He and his wife, Gail Huff, said they had no idea the comments would be regarded as offensive, and the takeaway was that they would be, quote, very, very careful about what they said in the future. That's two verys, ladies and gentlemen. That's enough for me. In the very department, News of Inspectors General, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. From New Orleans, this is Le Show, and now news of AFAC. Hurts when I do that. It hurts when I do almost, no, not true at all. Dateline Kabul. I don't know if you saw this. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson this week. Where was he? He was making back-to-back unannounced visits to Afghanistan and Iraq Monday. Now, these are two countries we've been in war with both of them. So, of course, he flew into both countries under great secrecy out of concern he might be a target for militants. Because we've got that thing. As his day stretched from before dawn to past midnight, covering almost 4,000 miles, Tillerson and his aides donned flak vests and helmets in Baghdad before boarding helicopters that took them to the U.S. Embassy and elsewhere in the Green Zone to meet with Iraqi's Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi and President Fuad Masoud. Tillerson's visit to Afghanistan was conducted in even greater secrecy and was announced only after he'd left the country. Because it's, you know, we have that nail. It was a two-hour secret visit to Afghanistan. The American Embassy and the office of President of Afghanistan, Ashraf Ghani, made statements about their productive meeting in Kabul, the capital. According to the BBC, the problem is the meeting wasn't in Kabul, but in a windowless room in Bagram, the heavily fortified American military base, a 90-minute drive away, where so much fine torture occurred earlier. The misinformation, apparently meant to obscure the true venue, was betrayed by discrepancies in similar photographs released by the Americans and the Afghans. Both show Secretary of State Tillerson and President Ghani sitting at the head of the room, two giant TV screens behind them. On the coffee table between them are a thermos, two cups, and bottled water. Their delegations sit across from each other. But the version released by Ghani's office missed or had missing a large digital clock showing Zulu time, which is the military term for Greenwich Mean Time, and a red fire alarm behind Mr. Tillerson and Mr. Ghani, which would be a giveaway that it was an American military facility. The photo released by the office of Afghanistan's president didn't show that. Ghani's office did not immediately respond to queries about why its version of the photo was different from that released by the Americans. Tillerson and his staff, who were on their way to Iraq for another secret meeting, did not immediately respond to questions about the discrepancy. There's no question the photo has been manipulated, says an expert in photo forensics at Dartmouth College. Method most likely done through Photoshop. Good guess, babe. The cable on the wall, well, anyway. Security concerns for the visit of Tillerson are justified because of the Taliban's resurgence. Last month, more than 50 rockets landed at and around Kabul airport during the visit of Defense Secretary James Mattis. Many Afghans may see the altered photo of Tillerson's visit as evidence of a government effort to twist facts to present a positive narrative. The Afghan government has changed facts before. At least one occasion, the Taliban have overrun the center of a district. The government has relocated the capital to someplace else so they could say they were still in control, according to the BBC. And the slaying of a physiotherapist at a Red Cross clinic. This is an international Red Cross clinic in a northern city in Afghanistan, followed the roadside killing of six Afghans working for the International Committee of the Red Cross, and three abductions in the past year, part of a spike in violence by smaller militias and the Taliban. It's led to more than 200 deaths in the past week alone. Last week is not alone. It has plenty of friends. The violence has prompted the International Aid Agency, the ICRC, to shut down two of its offices in northern Afghanistan and to scale down operations in that particular town, Mazar-e-Sharif, a decision that will affect hundreds of thousands of Afghans who receive aid from the organization. The places where you have war and insecurity are the places where your help is needed, said a doctor who during the early 90s spearheaded the creation of the ICRC's orthopedic program, which treats 160,000 people annually across the country. At the same time, he continues, you cannot deliver it. If we cannot guarantee the security of our staff, how can we work? He asks rhetorically. Somewhat less rhetorically, here's how it looks from over there.
From Afghanistan Public Radio, where the pledge drive never ends. From the abandoned American television track in downtown Kabul, the city that knows how to be at war, I'm Mahmoud.
And I'm Hamid. We're Schlock and Croc, the Darned Brothers. Welcome to another edition of the show that features Karzai's talking. Yes, it's Karzai Talk. Today's program comes to you with the assistance of the Afghan Automobile Club. Safe driving is our dream.
Well, my younger brother, fighting season is almost over, and yet the fighting continues.
Yes, this Trump thing had more repercussions than we thought. But seriously, my younger brother, our Pakistani friends say their support of the Taliban is weakening.
Yes.
So I guess our Taliban friends are saying, who needs Pakistanis?
Maybe it's much simpler.
Oh?
Maybe our Taliban friends have just finally received the wool uniforms they ordered
for the winter time.
Yes.
Hello, you're on Karzai Talk.
Hello, this is Rex, not longtime Secretary of State at this rate, first-time caller.
Oh, Mr. Secretary, what an honor to have on our program a man said by those in the know to be President Trump's cerebral cortex in hiding.
I have to apologize for my younger brother, Mr. Secretary. He has a problem with authority figures.
Oh, I have a problem with figures, period. You should see my Toyota dealership books.
No, I'm not your lawyer, but I don't think anyone should see those books. But Mr. Secretary,
yes.
Are you still in our country? Is this a local call?
Oh, well, to tell you the truth, Hamid, our steady progress in pacifying your country has not yet reached the tipping point where I can remain there for more than 3 hours tops.
Oh, well, that would be the topping point.
Yes, it would. And of course, we can only learn that you came here After you've left.
For security reasons, of course.
Well, basically so I don't get stalked at the airport by the TMZ guys.
Mr. Secretary, I have a question.
No, Mahmoud, I don't want to trade in my Lexus SUV for a Toyota Highlander.
No, even more serious questions.
Oh, we switching formats?
No. Was the photograph of you with President Ghani supposedly meeting in Kabul airbrushed to conceal the fact that you actually met in Bagram?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that question, Mahmoud.
I am too. It filled 20 whole seconds.
Actually, the answer is much simpler.
So is the questioner.
Will you stop?
In fact, as part of our new cooperation agreement with the Afghan government, they agreed to build a near-exact replica of the Bagram conference room in the presidential palace as a concrete expression of the unity of our positions.
More plaster and wood than concrete, though, right?
Well,
and the telltale clock wasn't part of the exact replica because
in Kabul no one cares what time it is.
Well, I'm a little hesitant about admitting this.
You forgot about the clock?
No, Congress found out we were funding this thing and lopped it out of the new budget just before we cut the check for the clock. It was always in the plans as part of our undying mutual commitment to our shared values.
Which include punctuality.
Yes, sir. Very much so.
Well, our clock says we don't have all the time in the world, so do you have a question for us?
Well, as you know, our administration is committing to a new infusion of American troops into your country. Honestly, now, Mr. Ex-President, how much of an effect do you think that will have on the course of the conflict?
Well, Mr. Secretary, as I understand it, your previous job for many years was head of Exxon.
That's correct. I was very proud of heading up the world's largest energy company.
Well, instead of sending us more troops, why don't you send us some Exxon stock?
Yes, we can sell it and buy off the Taliban chieftains.
That's a good idea.
Well, unfortunately, the ethics rules in our government prohibit that sort of thing.
Oh. Well, then just give us a few of the Trump hotels.
Thanks for the call.
Although I don't know how much those hotels would fetch on the open market these days.
Not a problem. Just change the brand to something with more widespread appeal. Like Corleone. Hello, you're on Cars I Talk.
Hello, this is Amal, a long-time listener. First time caller.
Oh, nice to have just a real person calling for a change.
Thank
instead
you.
Of all these officials all the time. This was starting to feel like Morning Joe without the Joe.
And the Mika.
And like the original without the Mark Halperin.
Go ahead, caller.
Thank you. I've heard that the International Red Cross is closing some clinics in the country.
That's right. They deemed the areas to be too unsafe to continue their work.
However, bronze policies will continue to be sold.
So what to those of us who need medical care in these areas, what do we do now?
Well, I'd say ask your doctor if Afghanistan is right for you.
But seriously, I have recommended that our American partners make available the services of the American Red Cross in this crisis situation.
Well, that's a fine idea, but won't they be scared away by the same threat of violence that has driven away the International Red Cross?
Not really.
You mean because the Americans are braver?
No, because the American Red Cross stays safe by focusing on fundraising. Thanks for the call.
I didn't call. We had help this week from the Afghan Boy Scouts. We'll admit girls when their merit badges are made of gold.
Legal services for Cars I Talk from the law firm of Ketchum & Newcomb. I'm Hamid.
And I'm Mahmoud.
Join us again for another non-rerun edition of Cars I Talk. This is APR, Afghanistan Public Radio.
Time to play. Here come Wednesday, I'll be to my side.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Maryland's Department of Transportation has removed a brochure from its website after several people pointed out that it contained a graphic that resembled a swastika. It was an unintentional mistake that has been corrected, said Transportation Secretary Pete Ron. A team member was using traffic jam clip art that is on numerous websites and did not recognize its resemblance to an offensive symbol, said Ron. I apologize to anyone who was offended. That would be a whoopology. Houston, Texans owner has apologized for describing NFL players as, quote, inmates running the prison, in reference to protests against racial injustice. It's usually the inmates running the asylum, isn't it? That's what he got. The protests have spread throughout the league, and as you know, Bob McNair, owner of the Texans, made his comments during a league meeting held to discuss the issue in New York. At the end of the week, he said he regretted using the expression. I never meant to offend anyone, and I was not referring to our players, he said in the statement. I used a figure of speech that was never intended to be taken literally. I meant asylum. No, I would never characterize our players or our league that way, and I apologize to anyone who was offended by it. A whoopology. After last week's meeting, the NFL said it will not force its players to stand during the national anthem. However, benches will be removed and the grass will be set on fire. The league's commissioner, Roger Goodell, said he would encourage players to stand, but wouldn't punish them if they didn't. A conservative member of the British government, Michael Gove, has apologized after making a joke about Harvey Weinstein on BBC Radio's flagship morning news program, The Today Program. He had been on the broadcast celebrating the 60th anniversary, really, of The Today Program? Yes. Asked by the presenter, John Humphreys, fine questioner, whether interviews on Today could make politicians look silly, Gove replied, well, I know what you mean. Sometimes I think that coming into the studio with you, John, is a bit like going into Harvey Weinstein's bedroom. The audience laughed, although some gasped. Or sat stony-faced. Gove faced a backlash, including from fellow MPs, before tweeting it had been a clumsy attempt at humor. He added, it wasn't appropriate. I'm sorry and apologize unreservedly. On a related subject, four women have now come forward with stories of alleged sexual harassment from former U.S. President George Herbert Walker Bush. Not the one you think. Not the one you'd expect. On Thursday night, following two stories by Heather Lind and Jordana Gralnick, author Christina Baker Klein published an essay for Slate chronicling a similar story. Bush groped her backside during a 2004 photo op while making a joke. You know what my favorite book is? David Copperfield. It's the same joke he used in his wheelchair-bound gropings reported earlier. His comic timing was impeccable, said Baker, when he put his arm around me low on my back, and he said, David Copperfield, and squeezed my butt hard just as a photographer snapped a photo. Instinctively, I swiped his hand away. And according to the Portland Press Herald, Amanda Staples, a former Maine Senate candidate, shared another eerily similar story when she posted a photo of her and Bush on her private Instagram account during a photo op in 2006. Bush, still not yet confined to a wheelchair, grabbed her backside and said, I'm not that president, presumably referring to Bill Clinton. Staples said she tried to excuse the incident, but when she told her dad about what happened, he was upset. Bush's rep, Jim McGrath, directed Slate to the same statement he made in response to the earlier stories. Quote, at age 93, President Bush has been confined to a wheelchair for roughly 5 years. So his arm falls on the lower waist of people with whom he takes pictures. To try to put people at ease, the president routinely tells the same joke, and on occasion, he has patted women's rears in what he intended to be a good-natured manner. Some have seen it as innocent. Others clearly view it as inappropriate. To anyone he's offended, President Bush apologizes most sincerely. It's to put you at ease. Don't you know what ease is? Houston Astros first baseman Yuli Gurriel faces potential discipline from Major League Baseball for making a racially insensitive gesture Friday night during Game 3 of the World Series. After hitting a home run in the second inning, Gurriel off of pitcher Yu Darvish. Why, Yu Darvish. Gurriel returned to the Astros dugout where he used his fingers to motion at his own eyes in a mocking gesture and appeared to mouth a derogatory term in Spanish. A baseball spokesman said, we're aware of the situation. The commissioner intends to speak with the player. Gurriel said he made the gesture because he hadn't had success in the past against Japanese pitchers. I did not mean it to be offensive at any point. Quite the opposite. I've always had a lot of respect for Japanese people. I never had any luck against Darvish. If I offended him, I apologize. That's an if-pology, ladies and gentlemen. Gurriel is a native of Cuba. Darvish is of Japanese and Iranian descent. Gurriel said it's common in Cuba to use the word chinito to describe someone of Asian heritage, although he admitted it's considered offensive in Japan. Darvish called the gesture and the word disrespectful. Ooh, World Series hotting up. And State Senator Jeff Clemons of Atlantis, and that would be in Florida. Yes, there is an Atlantis above the water for now, but it's in Florida. He's in line to become Democratic leader in the Florida State Senate, but he abruptly resigned this week after Politico reported he had an extramarital affair with a lobbyist. I've made mistakes I'm ashamed of, and for the past 6 months I have been focusing on becoming a better person. But it is clear to me that task is impossible to finish while in elected office. I guess what he's saying is it's hard to be a better person while you're serving in elective office. Is that what he's saying? The process won't allow it, and the people of Florida deserve better. What is it about the process? What's he saying? The process won't allow it. All women deserve respect, and by my actions, I feel I have failed that standard. I have to do better, Clemons said in a statement. And he apologized. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Addie the Atom is on the, we filed a missing animals report, but TEPCO says this week all 1,010 vehicles contaminated by the 2011 Fukushima nuclear disaster that are currently designated for use at the crippled plant will be scrapped by the end of fiscal 2020. It's now undesirable for tainted automobiles to continue operating at the site of the plant, says TEPCO. And workers at the Hanford site violated multiple state laws and regulations in August when they dumped thousands of gallons of contaminated water straight into the soil. The workers were dumping rainwater from the containers employed by Washington River Protection Solutions. Well, in that case, I guess the solutions are part of the problems. But good way to protect a river, everybody. In nearly 25 years of working here, I've never seen anything like that, said one Hanford worker. As you know, it's made plutonium for years, and now we're cleaning it up. Use clean, cheap, safe to safe to meter, our friends the Atom. Ladies and gentlemen, you've figured out by now that musical portions of this program today were a tribute to the late, amazing Fats Domino. I had the opportunity to see him at Jazz Fest here in New Orleans, in maybe not his last, but one of his last appearances, and he retained his energy, his spirit, his voice, his piano playing. It was all there on display, remarkably so. And it'd just be like not dumping all that contaminated water in the soil that will empty into the river. If you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. Tip of the Show. Chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Exile in Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead and to Thomas Walsh here at WWNO New Orleans for help with today's broadcast. The email address for this program, playlist. Wow, the music's ending early. What a surprise. As I say, the email address for this program, it's right here. It said it was going to last longer. The email address for this program, playlist of the music heard here on, and your chance to get Cars I Talk t-shirts, all at harryshearer.com. And I'm on Twitter, at the Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy radio network. Have a beautiful autumn day or evening wherever you are. So long, ladies and gentlemen, from the Crescent City, New Orleans.